This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island. From the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you.
Welcome back, everybody, to the People Speak Radio Show. I'm your host for tonight, Steve Johnson. The People Speak Show normally airs every Tuesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Pacific and 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern on the BBS Radio Network. You can participate during the show with calling questions for our guests toll-free in the USA and Canada on 1-888-429-5471. This is a fantastic show tonight. I'm more excited than Hillary in a pizza shop. We're talking to a very special guest right here. Dale Lepp is a professor of Near Eastern Studies and a spokesperson for Isaiah 58. Welcome to the People Speak Show, Professor Lepp, sir.
Having me.
It's fantastic to have you. We'll be taking audience questions after the first half hour, but my first question to you tonight is, can you tell me, how did you first hear about what Israel are doing to the Palestinian people?
Wow. Well, let's see. I went to grad school at Berkeley, and one of my tasks was to teach as a graduate assistant for a class called Introduction to the Middle East. So it's sort of a broad scope of Middle Eastern history. And there were a couple of units in that class on the history of the Palestinian conflict and the history of the State of Israel, which I knew a little bit about already, but I learned a lot more. When you have to teach somebody else about something, you learn a lot about it. And I would say there, and oddly, perhaps, my teacher of modern Hebrew was an Israeli woman and a very powerful and adamant defender of the Palestinian people. So I would say those were sort of my first two forays into the history of the Palestinian question and problem.
Did your research get right into the Balfour Declaration and the involvement of the Rothschilds as well?
Oh, certainly. So part of our curriculum in teaching the introduction to the Middle East, we spent a fair amount of time on British colonialism and the Balfour Declaration. In other words, the typical strategy of the British was to whatever area they were colonizing in the world, or to make sure that the people that they were colonizing were in conflict. So this, I think, was one strategy. In other words, to set up sort of two conflicting groups of people and to keep them at odds with each other, to draw attention away from the fact that they were being occupied by the British. But yeah, we spent a lot of time on that.
And did your course cover some of the terrorism that were involved in the Ergun and Stern gangs, for example?
Oh, absolutely. And this was sort of more where my teacher of Biblical Hebrew, or not Biblical Hebrew, modern Hebrew, talked a lot about the Stern gang and the history of Ergun and the fact that Menachem Begin had participated in a plot to blow up the King David Hotel. So it's not as though the founders of the State of Israel were immune to tactics of terrorism and working against the British and for their own ends. So yeah, we cover that as well. So I'm familiar with that too.
Fantastic. It sounds like you've really done your research, and indeed you're teaching others about this. That's truly a blessed thing. Do you not agree?
Yeah, no, I think it's a great story to share. It's a complicated story. And one that a lot of people sort of only know a few things about. So if people are open to engaging the facts, I think that it makes for a very enlightening discussion of the role of imperialism in the world and kind of what we do with bad history and how we address the problems that that brings to the present time.
When we talk to modern-day Zionists these days, their whole argument is based solely around their contention that God gave them that land, that that's their land because God gave them that land. Do you think God is a real estate agent that hands out land packages to people?
Well, no, I don't think so. And interestingly enough, those arguments, because I teach Old Testament as well, so I'm pretty familiar with the text that they refer to. And there is one passage of the Bible where God promises Abraham the land to him and his descendants, who will be as numerous as the stars of the sky. Then there's another passage that sort of reiterates that same promise a little bit later on. But the piece that people forget is that Abraham had many descendants besides the Israelites. So traditionally, you know, he is seen as the father of the Arab people. Now, whether that works out to actual DNA, you know, that I think is questionable. But and then Abraham had several wives and more offspring by his third wife. So if you look at all of the descendants of Abraham, if you were to sort of take that as serious history, that would include far more than the Israelites and would include far more than the modern-day Jewish people, which sort of see their own history as a subset of the Israelite people. So you're right that modern-day Zionists sort of look at the Bible as their sort of deed to the land, and I think that's problematic for a number of reasons. First of all, it doesn't really fit with what is actually in the Bible, and second, I think it's a poor way of establishing land rights in the modern world. So we don't think of land in the way that they thought of it back in ancient Israel, that's for sure.
And it's not just a religious contention either. It is indeed a political one when the aspect of Zionism gets involved. Would you agree with that?
Yes, I would to a certain extent. I think the interesting aspect of this is how Zionism has become intertwined with various strands of modern-day Judaism. Now, I don't want to paint too much of a broad brush saying that all modern-day Jews are Zionists, which they are not. But there is certainly a subset of Judaism that is very attached to the notion of Zionism, and with that, attached to the notion of the modern-day and even contemporary state of Israel, and that somehow, for some people, again, not all Jews, but for some Jews, the existence of the state of Israel has become almost a religious claim, which I think is a very sort of odd thing for a religion to do in some respects. So I think that is a problem in modern day Judaism, just from my perspective and my studies. We're in Jewish studies, so I do know a fair amount about the history and contemporary Jewish culture. I think what's probably most interesting now is in the modern-day political climate, seeing figures within the Israeli government aligning themselves closely with the incoming Trump administration, who seem to have elements of kind of anti-Semitism, at least arguably so. So now this seems quite a confused situation. It'll be interesting to see how all that plays out over the next, hopefully, only 4 years. So we'll see.
Right, right. But is it not true that calling somebody anti-Semitic, that's just a trick that they use to shut down any criticism of Israel? Is that not correct?
That is correct, that there are many Zionists who will say that any criticism of the modern-day state of Israel is, in effect, anti-Semitic. And this is, as you aptly mentioned, is a technique to try to shut down discussion of any criticism of the state of Israel. You know, there's no modern day government that is above criticism of some type. So it seems that anytime anyone wants to say that, you know, the state of Israel is acting in a discriminatory or a even racist manner in this one particular aspect, that immediately you are called anti-Semitic. And as you said, this is a way to shut down the conversation, I think. And it seems that the tactic now is to develop laws within states, within the United States. And now there was a law recently passed in Great Britain to try to even more closely link protest against the modern-day state of Israel with anti-Semitic speech. And this is a big issue on college campuses in the U.S. So this is another aspect of the discussion that seems to be coming to a head in our current culture.
Right, right. Well, one thing that I find very curious is groups like the Orthodox Jewish Neturei Karder, they contend that Israel should not even exist according to the religious books, because God said Israel shall not have a state. Do you find that there is some sort of confusion amongst the Jewish people in Israel that don't even know that their own passages of the Bible that say that thing?
I think, yes, there is some confusion in the modern-day state of Israel, but I think it's important to know that not all people living in the modern state of Israel are Zionists, and I think that comes as a surprise to many people. But, for example, if you travel to the what is commonly termed the ultra-Orthodox neighborhood in Jerusalem, Mea Shearim, if you're able to read Hebrew, there are many anti-Zionist plaques and posters in the area sort of condemning the modern state of Israel, saying that it's, you know, this is sort of a facade or an imitation of sort of what should be a kind of more enlightened or messianic government. So it's not even that all Israelis necessarily support the idea of Zionism itself. Some of them are very opposed to Zionism. And of course, we in the United States never or rarely hear about the existence of such ideas or people within the state of Israel. Obviously, there are Israelis that support the idea of the state of Israel, but are against colonization of Palestinian areas. So, you know, like anyone else, Israelis are sort of all, you know, their ideas run the gamut from, you know, aggressive Zionism and colonization to really being sort of thinking that the modern state of Israel shouldn't even exist. So it's important to remember that there is a spectrum of views even among Israelis.
You know, one thing I found very, very curious is that many members of the Knesset and the Israeli parliament, they're not Jews themselves either. They identify themselves as what's called Ashkenazis. And essentially, these are atheists. Do you find it quite ironic?
Yes. So if you look at the history of the State of Israel from 1948, the State of Israel was founded and essentially controlled by what are called Ashkenazi Jews. So an Ashkenazi Jew is, I guess, let's just say a shorthand way of talking about it, are European Jews that immigrated to the State of Israel beginning in the early 1900s and on through, I would say, I guess, to the present day, but from the 1900s through the end of and after World War II. So these are European Jews that look very European. And to maintain a Jewish majority within the boundaries of the State of Israel, the people, the Jews living there had to encourage immigration from other parts of the world. In other words, to keep the numbers up so that they would ensure a majority Jewish population for a Jewish state, immigration from other parts of the Middle East had to be encouraged. So many Jews came from Iraq and from Iran and from Africa. These Jews are known as Mizrahi Jews, which is a term just means Middle Eastern Jews, typically of darker complexion. And I would say during the entire history of the State of Israel, which isn't all that long, since 1948, Middle Eastern Jews have been subject to a great deal of discrimination at the hands of the Ashkenazi Jews, who are the European immigrants. So even within Jewish society, there is a division between a Judaism that's racially defined in one way versus a Judaism that's racially defined in another way. So it's a complex society, even removing the question of the Palestinian people. It's sort of a fascinating but yet very complicated mm-hmm. society.
And going even further back, we can see a lot of the converts that were converted actually come from the country of Khazaria, these Khazars. Is that not correct?
At least that's the legend. So the Ashkenazi Jews trace their history back to the Khazari Jews, which lived somewhere. I've sort of gotten vague on the question. Modern day,
modern day Ukraine.
The Ukraine, yes, and So again, I mentioned earlier whether these European Jews actually, if it were possible to trace their DNA back to a theoretical Abraham, would they be Abrahamic Jews? I don't really know, but I think it shows the problem of basing any state on some sort of ethnic definition. So how do you define a modern day state based on ethnicity? Knowing what we know now about DNA and, the people in the ancient world even then moved around a lot. And, who's to say who is an ethnic Jew, and to say that with any certainty? So defining a state based on an ethnicity was a very popular idea in, after World War I, but I think now we see that that's not a realistic way to live in the modern world, that you're always going to have a somewhat pluralistic society. No society, even the most monolithic societies, maybe like, Japan, ethnically monolithic. There will always be some minority people. And then what is the status of those minority people? Can they be treated as full citizens of a state? So the idea of an ethnic state, I think, has been called into serious question.
And of course, what we're seeing in the West Bank and Gaza right now is ethnic cleansing. It certainly is almost reminiscent of what the Nazis did to the Jewish people during the Second World War. Would you contend with that?
Yeah, I would agree that is the case. If you want to look for a really good analogy, although it hits much closer to home, I would look at what happened in North America over the 19th century, particularly, where there were immigrants from Europe that moved in to on the East Coast, and eventually they decided that they should own everything. And over time, that's kind of what happened. Even the Israeli government uses terms from the experience of the United States so that it sort of sounds more appealing to the American people. So the Israelis talk about the colonization of the West Bank as settlements, and in the United States we talk about moving the westward expansion as settling the western part of the United States. Therefore, by analogy, Palestinians are portrayed as, sort of uneducated savages, like the Native Americans were portrayed as sort of this, vicious, terroristic people that needed to be eliminated. So although people don't like to talk about those parallels very much because they hit a little close to home, we have our own history of ethnic cleansing as well, but it's I think a good way for us to get our heads around, as Americans, what's happening in Gaza and the West Bank to try to get rid of or isolate or set aside people in a very restricted area like a reservation. There's a lot of parallels between what happened in the U.S. in the 19th century and what's happening in the West Bank and Gaza today.
Yes, indeed. Well, one thing that I find completely repulsive and really blows me away is that a lot of these Israeli parliament members, and of course a lot of Israelis, they openly brag about how many Arabs have been killed and openly rejoice for killing Arabs. Do you find that's the total antithesis of what a religious nation should be?
Well, certainly it doesn't seem to reflect, I would say, even Jewish values in terms of the rights of people, and it just comes across as very inauthentic. There's a great movie, and I can't remember the name of it right off the top of my head, where during one of the incursions into Gaza, people on the Israeli side of Gaza have set up lawn chairs and are watching the bombing of Gaza and sort of cheering as each bomb lands, and it's really a frightening idea that there is so much animosity and hatred that you can be happy when someone is eliminated. But you know, that's come across, you know, it's come up over you know, many decades of indoctrination, and you know, it's kind of a sad result of this ideology.
Well, that to me shows that a lot of these people who do cheerlead for genocide, that they've lost a lot of their humanity. Would you not agree with that?
Yeah, I would agree with that. It's again, I don't think the mystery to me is that none of this seems congruent with Jewish values, with ideas just on a basic understanding of human rights. So other than just simply asserting that, you know, this land is ours, these people need to get out, it's just kind of an abandonment of the values of human rights and human dignity.
One thing I find very, very curious after doing my research into the Jewish holidays, for example, like Hanukkah, Purim, Passover, all of these holidays are based on events where genocides have happened, and yet they turn these into holidays and celebrate that. Do you find that quite ironic?
I do find it ironic in a way, although you know, my job is to teach the Bible, and interestingly, if you look at sort of the story of the Israelites taken as a whole, they are they go to Egypt because they think the living is better there, and eventually they're enslaved, and you know, God frees them, and they you know, move and enter the promised land. But eventually, they sort of become like the people that enslaved them. They in turn, you want to kill off the people that are in the land. They want to, you know, become sort of a tiny imperialist society, in the way that they're portrayed in the Bible. They don't follow kind of the ideas, the legal and governmental ideas that are set out before them. So interestingly, even in the Bible, get to my point here, the Israelites become that which they hate and that which they needed to be freed from. And I'm not saying this that this only applies to modern-day Jews, but I think you can see this in a lot of different cultures in the world where once people are freed from colonialism, you know, like think of the countries in northern Africa, for example. Once people are freed from colonialism, typically the next government that comes in is extremely oppressive. And it seems that by experiencing this oppression, people come to feel, maybe this is just part of the human psyche, that they have to oppress someone else.
They feel empowered.
They feel empowered to not be that oppressed person, but in sort of escaping that oppression, they somehow become oppressors too. So I don't want to make it sound like this only happens to modern day Jews, but it's a story that kind of repeats itself. If you read about it in the Bible and you look at it in terms of modern history, history has repeated itself in that instance, and I would say in other instances too. So it's not it's not an unusual thing, but it's a sad thing.
Absolutely. There is a saying that those who forget their history are doomed to repeat it. So I do believe you have a very good point there. Can you tell me what was the final straw that convinced your church to embrace the BDS policies towards Israel? What was the final straw that made your church decide to go down that path?
Wow, that's an interesting question. Here's my take on it, which is just my opinion. Over time, I think support of Israel in the U.S., even today, largely stems from a Cold War mentality. People remember kind of Israel being aligned with the United States and the surrounding countries, for example, Egypt and Jordan and Syria, being either non-aligned nations or aligned with the Soviet Union. And I think through the mentality and people that are my age, middle age, and older, they still think of the state of Israel in that way, that Israel is on our side and everyone else in the whole area is against us. So what I think has happened in our church is that as more and more young people have come up through the ranks, so we have more young people attending our National Assembly and are able to have a voice and a vote in our National Assembly, that attitudes over time have changed and that there is a generational divide there, and that finally enough younger people who probably have a better understanding of the Palestinian situation have a voice, and that the old guard, people like me, are having less and less of a voice. And so I don't know if there was one particular straw necessarily, but sort of that this, I would portray it more as a tipping point, that at this particular point in time, the church found enough support to be able to say that at least on a couple of points, we want to support the Palestinian people.
When we have in America approximately 20 million people are homeless every single night that goes on in America, I find it reprehensible myself that America funds Israel to the tune of $9 million a day in foreign aid and in military aid. Do you think that that's what is turning people's minds, that we're giving just too much money when so much could be done on America itself?
I think that that approach may appeal to some people, that it's just a ridiculous amount of money. I think most people in just looking at our church that support Palestinian causes see it more as a human rights issue. And granted that the money is just kind of a stick in the eye on top of the fact that these people are being treated horrendously. But that also the church recognizes that if the U.S., and we'll understand that broadly, the U.S. government, U.S. agencies, particularly Jewish agencies in the U.S., if we were not sending money to Israel in the form of armed support or aid or what have you, if that weren't happening, Israel would not be able to continue. The state of Israel would not be able to continue in its present form without U.S. funding. So I think people in our church also feel a sense of responsibility, the fact that as U.S. taxpayers, we are funding this occupation, and we don't want to put ourselves in a position where we fund the occupation. So yes, certainly I think this money could be used in much better ways, but I think I don't think that's the first place that people in our church go to, but see it more as I don't want to be personally responsible for this.
At that right, time. Right. Well, please do stick with us, Professor Lepp. This is the People Speak Radio Show. I'm your host, Steve Johnson, talking with very special guest, Professor Dale Lepp, live on Internet Radio. And we'll be right back with our guest and audience questions after this short message break.
You're listening to BBS Radio. If it's not mainstream, it's on bbsradio.com.
With over 150 million registered users, Pal Talk is the largest video chat community in the world, with over 300 Pal Talk support staff speaking dozens of languages to help you enjoy your online experience. Meet new people across town or country or continent while chatting about your interests. Sing live karaoke, listen to music, join a lively political debate, or play group trivia in one of thousands of chat rooms in various categories from your PC, mobile, or tablet device. Joining Pal Talk is free and easy. Go to paltalk.com and become part of our friendly community today.
Hi, I'm Richard Belzer. This is the great BBS Radio.
Today's school libraries are filled with endless opportunities. With access to print and digital materials, the latest technologies, and the guidance of a school librarian, our children are empowered with the tools they need to succeed in school and beyond. I'm Julianne Moore. Join me in celebrating all of the ways that school libraries and librarians are transforming learning for our students. For more information on how you can become involved, visit the American Association of School Librarians at aasl.org.
This land is yours.
Join us on The People Speak for an hour of live interviews and audience interaction as guests of various organizations share their work and strategies which impact our world and make a difference. That's The People Speak, every Tuesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Pacific, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern, on the BBS Radio Network.
This land was made for you and me.
You're listening to the People Speak Radio Show, coming to you live across America and across the world on the BBS Radio Network. I'm your host for tonight, Steve Johnson, and we're back with our very special guest, Professor Lepp, spokesperson for the group ELCA. I encourage all the listeners to visit his website at www.isaiah58.info. Welcome back there, Professor Lepp, sir.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Have you had any harassment or intimidation since you've decided to go down the path of the BDS policies?
I've had a few, harassing emails, I guess, and I get trolled on Twitter a lot, but other than that, I haven't really experienced a lot of harassment though. I'm thankful for that, but a few people have not wished me well, but that's fine. It was something I expected getting involved in this, so I'm okay with that.
For sure, for sure. And it's not just your Lutheran church that's boycotting Israel. How many others are also falling into line and doing that also? Have you heard of any others?
Yes. Yeah, so there are similar activities in the Presbyterian Church USA, which is probably the furthest along, actually, in this process. And there's also the United Church of Christ has taken actions in this direction. The Unitarian Universalist Church has taken some actions in this direction. So we're probably about the fourth church that has, every church sort of approaches it a little bit differently, and our approach is unique to our church. But we, at least those of us that got this, got these amendments, or excuse me, resolutions passed, pride ourselves in the fact that this is the largest church body. So we're about 3.6 million members, roughly, that we're the largest church body that has passed such resolutions at their annual assembly. So it seems to be a growing movement, and there have been, victories on college campuses and, other venues as well. So even though it seems there's a lot of legal pushback and state legislatures and even foreign governments, I think people are beginning to sort of get on board and see the situation for what it is, which is encouraging.
Absolutely. And even though there is a growing movement and a more understanding about what's happening in Palestine, a lot of Christians still follow the Zionist ploy that we have to support Israel, otherwise God will curse us. Do you see that some of these Christians, especially the TV evangelists, they espouse this stuff knowing that they're brainwashing people? Would you agree with that?
Yes, I would absolutely agree with that. There is a great deal of Christian, what some people refer to as Christian Zionism, within probably more evangelical Christian denominations and groups in the U.S. That have the idea that we must support the state of Israel no matter what, otherwise something terribly bad is going to happen to us. And of course, the text that they base this on is the one I referred to earlier about God blessing Abraham. And, Abraham was father of lots of people. So it's not just the Jews that are, if you want to read the Bible literally, it's not just the Jews that are under his protection, but a lot of other people. Fortunately, when we started to debate these resolutions at our assembly, I was a little worried that arguments like that would come up, because I know that even though that's not an overwhelmingly popular viewpoint within our own denomination, there are people, I'm sure, that still think along those lines. And we were ready for those types of objections. Fortunately, though, they didn't come up, at least at this assembly. So I was sort of happy to not have to fight that particular battle. And in my imagination, at least, I hope that there are only a few people in our denomination that think that way. But I'm probably wrong about that, but that's what I like to think.
Yeah. I find it ironic also that a lot of these Zionist Christians in America, they've got no idea how the rabid Zionists in Israel actually mock Jesus, and they mock the Christians, and they actually hate these Christians that are supporting them. Is that not true?
So one of the religious practices for Christians in Jerusalem is to do what is called the Stations of the Cross, or what is called the Via Dolorosa. So what you do is you walk along the path of Jesus' last hours. So it's sort of I wouldn't call it a reenactment, but a commemoration of Jesus' trial and death while he was in Jerusalem. And you follow this path, and there are 12 stations that you stop at, and there are special prayers that you say when you stop there. And it's not unusual, and this has actually happened to me, that sadly, there are some Jewish people that will see you carrying this cross. They know what you're doing, and they will spit on you for, I guess, desecrating their city or being present in their
city.
So there is a lot of Jewish animosity against Jesus, and going through a program in Jewish studies, I've certainly heard of people that would say, like, well, I don't think this way, but my mom is sort of adamantly anti-Jesus, and won't allow his name to be mentioned in the house. So, there are those attitudes that are floating around out there. I don't know if people just aren't aware of them or want to ignore them for a sort of a bigger picture or what that is. But there are some Jews, again, I don't want to paint with a broad brush, there's many, lots of diversity within Judaism and within Israelis, but there are some Israelis that are indeed very anti-Christian and anti-Jesus. And I think that would come as a surprise to Christian Zionists, at least I hope.
One thing I find reprehensible is that traditionally, all through history, even when the Crusaders had taken over Jerusalem, it was a place that was always accepting of any religion, of Jews, Christians, Muslims, were all free to come and worship in that city. But that's changed today. It is predominantly only Jews that are allowed. Do you find that?
Certainly, over the course of the years, there are more and more restrictions for Muslims to pray at the the Dome of the Rock and the mosque that is sort of sits on the central site within Jerusalem. So that is becoming increasingly restricted. Because of the negative attitudes toward Christianity, there are simply fewer and fewer Christians living in Jerusalem and in the West Bank, just because a lot of them don't want to put up with living behind a wall or being subject to checkpoints every day. So they move elsewhere. They move to the United States. They move to other places in the world, which of course makes, you know, the Israelis that want to see them go, that makes them very happy and is part of the strategy. So over time, the number of Christians has simply dwindled in Jerusalem. And I think that that makes the status quo very happy, unfortunately. So it would be nice to have Jerusalem be a free city open to all for worship or not worship, for history, for whatever reason you might want to come to Jerusalem. And actually in 1948, when the UN proposed their plan for the withdrawal of the British colonial force and for the separation of the land between Arabs and Jews, they called for Jerusalem to be a free city administered by the UN. And to me, even though that idea is now, going on, 50, 75 years old, it still probably makes the most sense for Jerusalem to be a free and open city. I'm not sure how you would pull that off, but I think that would make the most sense.
For sure. We do have a question from the audience. Mike in California would like to know, is Professor Lepp aware that the state of California is making it illegal for businesses to boycott Israel? Are you aware of that?
Yes. Sadly, the state of California, the legislature, passed a law just this last session that companies that do business with the state of California cannot have as their company policy a boycott of any sort of boycott of the state of Israel, which to me cannot be constitutional. And even though the legislature passed this law, I was so sure that our governor, Jerry Brown, who was involved in all sorts of actions and demonstrations as a young person, I thought there is no way our governor will ever sign this legislation. And I was completely wrong. He did sign this legislation. So now legislation there are similar statutes being passed in other states like the state of New York and so forth. So now these are going to have to be challenged in the courts. But yes, I'm sadly aware of that.
It was, in fact, the sanctions and the boycotts of the apartheid state of South Africa that eventually led to the crumbling of their government and the institutionalization and freeing of all the African slaves prisoners, political prisoners. Do you think that same sort of thing is going to happen in Israel?
Well, I hope so. I think that's the idea, that with public pressure, eventually the state of Israel, there has to be a condition created wherein it's less advantageous for the state of Israel to continue down the current status quo, which is increased colonization of the West Bank, building new housing developments and so forth, where that is less advantageous than some other path. And for that to happen, so right now, it's more advantageous for the state of Israel to just continue going down the path that they have. And that's what they're doing. So something has to happen to make that less advantageous for them. And I think the only way to do that is a South Africa type of strategy. So
we have a question from, go ahead.
No, that's it.
Okay, we have a question from Moon Cyclone in Ohio who would like to know, is it true that many high-ranking government employees in the United States have dual citizenship with Israel?
Wow. that I don't know. I am not sure about that. I'm just trying to think of people that I know that have dual citizenship. I'm sorry, I just don't know the answer to that question. That would be interesting to know.
I can name a few off the top of my head: Paul Wolfowitz, Nancy Pelosi, people like that. That they certainly do have a connection to that state of Israel.
They do have a connection. I have no idea if they have dual citizenship. One interesting thing, though, that I find, this is purely anecdotal. So I live in San Jose, and nearby we have Silicon Valley, and particularly Palo Alto. So when I go to Palo Alto downtown there, and because I speak modern Hebrew, I recognize the language right away, there are tons of Israelis in Palo Alto. Why this is the case, I have never asked before, but it would be interesting to know how many Israeli citizens actually live in the U.S. and what they're doing here. I have no idea what's going on there, but I think it's really interesting.
Can you explain to the people who are listening, the audience, why it's important to stop funding the Zionist occupation in Palestine? Why is that important?
Well, for our church, it's important because we consider it a moral issue. So we don't want to be involved in something, in a project that's just so clearly oppressive that that it brings daily harm to people. Some are fellow Christians. Some of whom are even fellow Lutherans. So there are actually Lutheran congregations in the West Bank. So from our standpoint, that's why we don't want to fund the State of Israel. I think from a broader, just foreign policy standpoint, if you think about it, let's face it, this is a troubled part of the world with lots of other conflicts going on. We've seen the horrific aftermath of the Syrian government invasion in Aleppo. That's just one center of conflict in a region that is in deep trouble, and I would say that is an aftermath of colonialization. But anyway, why in the world would we want to pump $3 billion worth of arms into this part of the world year after year after year, or almost now $4 billion worth of arms into this part of the world? Just at a policy, as a strategic standpoint, an idea of a foreign policy making sense, that is just it seems on its surface to be a very bad idea. And so I think even if you don't have moral qualms about supporting the occupation, just think of it from a practical standpoint. Think of it from, like as you were mentioning earlier, we have a lot of other things we could be funding. Why should we be dumping billions of dollars worth of arms into this part of the world? That just makes no sense.
What really blew me away when I first started my YouTube channel, Stop Funding Israel, what really blew me away first was exactly how many companies and corporations around the world are actually giving money every year to the State of Israel. These companies include Coca-Cola, Starbucks, Caterpillar, Revlon, Nestle, L'Oreal. Does your church actively target these companies to tell people to avoid spending money for them?
We have not really gone down that route. So BDS, which stands for Boycott, Divestings, and Sanctions, which is sort of the three-pronged approach for dealing with the Israeli occupation, our church itself is not really into the B of BDS. So and I think part of that has to do with the fact that to do an ongoing boycott, you have to sort of maintain a list of bad companies. And I think we have not wanted to go down the road of fighting over who, every 3 years when we meet, fighting over who should be on that list. So we are much more interested in making public statements, but also divestment. So that is kind of the new prong where our church has developed or is making some inroads into divesting from companies that invest in the state of Israel and invest in the occupation. And through shareholder advocacy and public statements, that we pressure companies in that matter. So I guess we've not been big on doing kind of the big public, you know, boycott Starbucks or boycott L'Oreal, but we've gone about it in another way. Maybe people could argue that that's something else we should do. I don't know, but that our church has chosen a different path for better or worse.
Well, it's fantastic anyway to know that people are waking up to that. And indeed, it was a few years ago that Cynthia McKinney came out. Are you aware that she actually came out and publicly stated that every single congressman, every single senator must sign a pledge to support Israel, otherwise they don't get funding? Have you heard about that?
I have not heard about that. So that's news to me. That's very, very interesting. Certainly the Israeli lobby, AIPAC and others are, you know, undoubtedly the most one of, if not the most powerful lobbies in Washington. I think when Bernie Sanders made a statement during the election that was, you know, only, you know, just slightly favorable to the Palestinians, people saw that as, you know, a huge departure from either Republican or Democratic, you know, rhetoric and ideology that sort of has given unequivocal support to the state of Israel. So certainly people in Congress get a lot of money from people that are, you know, that support the state of Israel. Sheldon Adelson, who's a big contributor to the Republican Party, is a huge supporter of Sheldon Adelson. So there's a lot of money. There's a lot of advocacy there. Whether people have to sign something, I had never heard that. But certainly the influence is there for, you know, it's obvious for anybody that wants to look at it.
We do have a question from Reggie in Maryland who would like to know, what is your opinion or synopsis on the Samson option talked about in regards to Israel? Have you heard of the Samson option?
I sure have not. I apologize. I don't know about that. It kind of sounds interesting. Just the name. Sorry. That's just not something I know about. Maybe I can
sure. Follow it up. I believe it was Seymour Hersh that wrote a book about the Samson option, which basically entails that Israel have placed nuclear devices in their diplomatic stations all around the world in major cities and have threatened different countries if they don't support Israel that they will let these things off, as in bringing down
gotcha.
The columns as Samson did. That's, mm-hmm. I believe, what the Samson option is.
Okay. That's interesting. Of course, as a Bible scholar, I know about the story of Samson. So Samson is basically a suicide terrorist. So he goes into a building and decides he's going to get rid of a bunch of Philistines and collapses the building, and he has to die in this process. So, wow. So that's written by Seymour Hersh, I guess. I hadn't read about this, so that's something I need to check into. It's really interesting. Mm.
It seems the state of Israel are blackmailing people on a massive scale. And of course, if Israel ever gets attacked, they've threatened to let these things off in the various capital cities, killing just about everybody on planet Earth. If they go down, they're going to bring the temple
Everyone
down with them. I believe that's
too.
Their...
Sorry,
go ahead.
That's really interesting. Oh, I was just going to say that you know, Israel is adamantly opposed to the U.S. deal with Iran. Iran, you know, in the U.S. effort to try to keep Iran from developing nuclear weapons. And, of course, it's long been known that Israel does have nuclear weapons, you know, whether this Samson option is something that that they've explored or not, that I don't know. But certainly they do have nuclear weapons and certainly have a highly technologically superior, some people even argue, superior to that of the United States. And I don't doubt that they would be willing to use their nuclear weapons if they thought it would be to their best interest. So it's it's just sort of an extension of that policy, I guess.
Have you had anyone in your church actually denounce what you're doing about the boycott and the divestment of Israel? Have you had anybody in your church that have actually found this to be not conscionable?
Oh, certainly. There have been objections on social media, at least within our denomination. Nobody within my specific congregation has said anything to me. If they disagree with it, they haven't told me to my face. So some people just can't sort of believe that that the church passed something like this. But yet our church assembly is made up of primarily lay people. They're chosen very methodically from districts throughout the United States, very, very representative of our denomination as a whole. And they passed the resolutions that we proposed by, you know, an 80 to 90% margin. It wasn't even close. So I think the people that are objecting are once again the people that are sort of still have this Cold War mentality that, with the idea that we must support Israel no matter what because they're our only friend in the region, et cetera, et cetera. And to them that this just seems unconscionable. But on the other hand, the denomination has spoken out against the state of Israel colonizing the West Bank already in 2005. You know, that's 11 years ago. So it's not like our positions are new. We're just strengthening the positions that we have. So it could be some people are just sort of out of touch where the rest of the denomination is. So we've gotten a little bit of pushback on social media, but honestly, it's not really been that much.
Last year, I had the fantastic opportunity to talk to Allison Weir, who wrote a book called Against Our Better Judgment. This book actually details how much the Zionist lobbies in America since the 1920s have been influencing both Congress and both Senate to push policies that are favorable to Israel. Do you see that actually happening today, or do you think that was something that happened a long time ago? I mean, the Zionist lobby in America is very powerful. Do you acknowledge that?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, without a doubt, I don't think there's even any question in my mind that the Zionist lobby is very powerful at many levels in the United States, and to me, that's a no-brainer.
Well, it's been fantastic having you on the show here, Professor Lepser. We're definitely going to have to get you again. I hope you've enjoyed the interview.
Sure, yeah, it was a great time. I really enjoyed talking about the situation in Palestine, and I appreciate you bringing me on. It was a lot of fun.
You've been listening to The People Speak Show with special guest and author Professor Dale Lepp. I'd like to thank him and remind all the listeners to visit his website at www.isaiah58.info. Thanks so much for being on the show today, Professor Lepp, sir.
Thank you.
God bless you always. Stay tuned for special guest Professor Hugo DeGaris coming up soon on The People Speak Show. Big thanks go out to the producers, Mike, Doug, and Donald, and to all the room admins and all my friends throughout the world, and to all the guys that give me so much support. Thank you from the bottom of my heart. You can tune in to my own channel on YouTube called Stop Funding Israel. But for me for now, take care, and bye until next time.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the steeple by the relief office, I saw my people, and they stood there hungry, and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is your land, this land is my land, from California to the New York Island, redwood forest to the Gulf Stream waters. Yeah, this land is made for you and me.